Living in Community was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 27, 2004, at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the fifth talk in part three of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm not sure why this topic is on the list.
You put it there.
I know. I'm still not sure why it's on the list. But we'll give it our best shot. I think there's two questions we have to start with here in order to get some background for attacking this issue. What I say may or may not be controversial. I'm not sure. I mean, some of you may really not like what I'm about to say. Maybe you'll think it's just makes a lot of sense, and why was it worth saying? The first question that I think comes to mind is we have a choice to make when we think about the Christian Christianity. Does Christian community emerge organically when individuals who believe the gospel come together? That's one option, one way of looking at Christian community. Or does an individual's belief in Christianity include a commitment on their part to work toward forging a community with others? Now, most people probably have never articulated that question to themselves, for themselves. But I've never taken a poll, but my guess is that most people would answer in the latter way rather than the former way. That just sort of in the air we breathe and the culture that we're surrounded with, I think there's a tendency to have promoted the idea that part of being a Christian is we would work toward living in community with other people. We need to build a community. Typically, it's less explicit than that. We don't so much talk about building a community, we talk about maybe building a church instead of community. But we mean the same thing. We mean a society and a culture of people who are relating to one another in a kind of significant and meaningful and distinctive kind of way that makes it a Christian community as opposed to just a collection of people. And the characteristics of that community should be things that are that signal the fact that we are Christians. We're not pagans, godless pagans out there in the world. We're Christians, and you can see by the community that we have forged together and that we're living in together. I'm going to argue that the first answer is closer to the biblical answer, and that in fact we are thinking wrongly about our faith if we think that to be a disciple of Jesus is to make a commitment to community. I'm not really sure that's true, but I'll get back to that. So there's that question, and how we're going to answer that will make a big difference how we answer the question of the relationship between our faith and community. There's another question I think we can raise, and that is, what's the purpose of Christianity? What's the purpose of the Christian faith? We could answer it, well, we could answer it in dozens of different ways, and I think people have answered that in dozens of different ways, but I'm only going to trot out a few here. We could say that the purpose of Christianity is to foster and to promote and to create community. That's what it's for. Or to teach us how to do community right. Or to teach us how to do society right. Now, I was very, very inclined to see the faith that way. I never would have articulated it that way, I don't think. If somebody had said, is this the purpose of Christianity, I probably wouldn't have quite known how to answer that. But as I was growing up as a college student through the 60s, this was a no-brainer. Well, yeah, of course. I mean, what the world needs is community. What the world needs is justice. What the world needs is peace. What the world needs is truth. And truth in our relationships with each other. And I don't think Marxism has the answer, and the hippies don't have the answer, and this group doesn't have the answer, and this group doesn't have the answer, but Jesus has the answer. Jesus is the one who teaches us how to do community right, how to do society right. And why then am I motivated to be a Christian? I'm motivated to be a Christian because the burning issues of our age, namely how to do society and culture right, are answered in Jesus. And so that's why I'm committed to him. Well, if you answer in any of those three ways as to the purpose of Christianity, then likely you're going to be sympathetic, at least, if not committed to the notion that part of Christian discipleship is to enter into what I will call, what others have called, intentional community. And let me define what I mean by that. I mean, everybody, to some extent or another, if you interact with other people, is in community. I mean, you can't, it's very difficult to get out of community. But are you purposing to join together with other people who have the same purpose as you do to learn to live with each other in a particular and distinctive way? And you are intending to build a community where there is love and there is truth and there is honesty and whatever virtues you define for it. You are intending to enter into a network of relationships with other people in what we call community, where you are working toward having the relationships characterized by certain distinctive values. Well, that would be intentional community. Now, one way to do that, of course, is to buy a mountain and all go live on the mountaintop together, or buy an old abandoned monastery and go live on the monastery together. You can do that, and that's more dramatic. You can go into a neighborhood and buy up a bunch of houses and all be neighbors together and spend a lot of time with one another and deliberately and intentionally enmesh your lives together in community and build an intentional community that way. Or you can just go to the same church, but make it your goal and your ambition together to build certain quality relationships among the church members and build intentional community that way. I mean, there are different faces that you can put on intentional community, but they all, in my mind, are driven by the same understanding that I cannot be a disciple of Jesus without entering into some kind of project of entering into an intentional community with other Christians. On the other hand, back to the question, what's the purpose of Christianity? There's another possible answer to that, and that is that the purpose of Christianity is to foster and promote an individual's being rightly related to the truth. And of course, you can't be rightly related to the truth without being rightly related to God, but that goes without saying for us as Christians. I underline and emphasize the word individual because what's being fostered is not some kind of social relationship between us or even an interpersonal relationship between us. What's being fostered is my own individual, deep down, subjective, existential commitment to God and what is true. Now, people coming from the other perspective, if I were to offer that answer, which I would, I mean, I think that's closer to the biblical answer to the purpose of Christianity. But in offering that answer, there are a number of people who would accuse me of being overly individualistic, too much an American, too solitary, that it misses the whole point, that it misses the whole point of our faith to be so, to propose such a isolated, lonely, individualistic understanding of our faith. But I offer that really without any embarrassment. I think that's the truth. I think people like Kierkegaard who have recognized that we make the commitment that we make in isolation. Nobody can make it for me. Nobody can be a believer on my behalf. I and I alone must commit. I and I alone must believe. I think that's absolutely right and absolutely in sync with everything that the Bible is saying. And I think that's fundamentally what Christianity is all about. I can be a believer on a desert island, and I can be a believer in the midst of a sea of people, none of whom are supportive of my faith. And it's entirely and completely possible to do that. It may be difficult to do that, but in principle and in theory, it's entirely possible to do that. So, as you can see, all of my assumptions and all of my perspectives about biblical faith don't tend to take me in the direction of seeing entering into intentional community as a fundamental part of what it means to be a Christian. Now, on the surface, I would argue that just a surface reading of the Bible is in support of my position rather than the opposite one. You just simply don't find the Bible explicitly teaching, look, go find a bunch of fellow believers and form a community together, you know, buy a mountain, you know, buy a neighborhood. The apostles don't explore that. They don't suggest that. They don't hint at that. That seems to be the furthest thing from their minds. That's not where they go. So if the Bible on the surface doesn't seem to suggest that, why do people think that the Bible is so supportive of their notion that we need to be pursuing intentional community? Well, I think the answer to that fundamentally lies in how attractive the idea of intentional community is. There is a fundamental human need and a fundamental human longing that is incredibly compelling. All of us have felt it, all of us know it, all of us have faced into it. We want connection with other people. We want some kind of intimacy, meaningful, significant intimacy with other people. We want friends. We want friendship. Friendship is a very attractive commodity to us as human beings. So if you have a version of Christianity that comes along and says, are you lonely? Do you need a friend? Do you feel like you're not connected to anybody? Well, there's two answers that Christianity tends to give to that. One is, Jesus will be your friend, is one answer. And secondly, become a Christian because the Christian faith teaches you to love one another. And you will find among your fellow believers, your fellow Christians, you will find that connection that you want and you will find that connection that you need. Well, that's very attractive to every one of us. The question is that what the gospel is promising? Is that what Christian discipleship is promising? Ultimately, I'm going to argue no, it's not. And we can come back to that. But my point for now is, but you can see if someone can promote or even suggest a version of the Christian faith that suggests that that need is going to be addressed by your Christian discipleship, well, of course you would like that. Of course you'd be attracted to believing that version of the faith. And then, to support it as biblical, the argument, I think, goes something like this. You can go to the Bible and you'll find endless number of passages that are going to teach something along the lines of love one another, an exhortation to us as believers to love one another. That's a given, obviously. That's true. No question the Bible teaches that. The next step of the argument goes, if we love one another, we will be connected to one another. Now, I'm going to argue that's half true. That's sort of true. There's a sense in which that's true. But it's true in a different sense from what I think we're wanting that to say and wanting that to mean. We'll come back to that. But that's a plausible step of the argument. If we love one another, we'll be connected to one another. From there, if we're connected to one another, we will be in community with one another, right? Not sure that's a valid inference, but it's an understandable inference. From there, it follows, if we are not in community then with one another, then we are failing to love one another. And all that sounds very, very plausible. I would argue that's a specious argument. It doesn't follow. It's neither logical nor true, But it's a very, very compelling argument if you don't think about it too long and too hard. Sounds right. Then the conclusion, therefore, in order to fulfill the biblical injunction to love one another, we must live in community with one another. And then any number of groups will appeal to you, if you don't come and join us in pursuing community together, then there's some kind of failure of your love. You do not love the way Jesus has called you to love. Okay, I'm going to identify, there may be more, but let me focus on what I think are three errors in that way of thinking. The first one is that the love that the Bible speaks of is not connection with other people in any sense that entails community. What does the Bible mean by love? There's two ways in which the New Testament, I'll just restrict it to the New Testament, but there's two ways in which the apostles in the New Testament address the issue of love. One is, as John puts it in 1 John, we are to love because God is love. And just as God has loved us, we are to love him, because if we do not love as God loved, we are not his children. And the basic logic seems to be, like father, like son, God is a God of love. If we are going to be his children, then we must be like him in the relevant respects. And one of the most relevant respects is we will have embraced the value of being loving. Otherwise, we don't know God. We don't know and love God if we don't love the fact that God is committed to love and is by nature loving. So the very nature of my relationship to God, who is my Father, is necessarily going to dictate my commitment to being a loving individual. Now, what does that mean, though? To be a loving individual, in the sense in which John is talking about it there, is that's the kind of love that Jesus is talking about when he teaches his disciples to love their enemies. When you love your enemy, you don't befriend your enemy. You don't experience a deep, profound connection with your enemy. You don't even feel simpatico with your enemy. By definition, you kind of hate him. So it's not this emotional connection that Jesus is exhorting us to or instructing us to obey. What he's getting at is to desire and work for the good of another person, the well-being of another person. That is to love them. And you can do that without a whole lot of emotional depth, or you can do that with a ton of emotional depth. I mean, the emotional depth is neither here nor there. What makes love love is the fact that I am promoting and desiring their well-being and taking active steps toward promoting their well-being. That's one sense of love that the apostles talk about. There's another and different sense in which the apostles talk about it, and this is typically when they're talking about loving one another or loving your brother. And that has to do with genuine connection, genuine simpatico of some kind. And the reasoning is, if I am in fact a child of the truth, a child of God, and therefore a seeker after truth, one who's positively responsive to truth, then I'm going to share an incredibly profound thing in common with other people who are positively receptive to truth. I'm going to understand them, and they are going to understand me in a way that the world will not understand me. The world thinks I'm an idiot, a clown, a fool, a self-righteous hypocrite. I mean, those are all the things they think about me. And they don't have a clue about what makes me tick. But my fellow believer understands what makes me tick. They understand that I have a hunger and thirst after righteousness, that I desire to know the truth, I desire to know God, I desire that I love God and am seeking to emulate him. I mean, the fellow believer understands all that. And I understand that about them. And that mutual shared understanding about the very commitments of my inner being that drive me and make me tick is an incredibly profound connection with that other person. And that's what the apostles describe as the bond of unity. The bond of unity is this connection that's shared because we are relating in exactly the same way to God, to Jesus, to the truth, and all that that entails. Well, one way of describing that affinity or that bond that we experience because of shared truth is love. An entirely different use of the word, an entirely different sense. The first one was a moral commitment. The second one truly is a kind of emotional, even interpersonal connectedness. But just like love in English, you can love everything from moccasins to ice cream to a woman. Greek has the same incredible broad field of meaning for the word love. Moccasins, I dated myself, didn't I? Okay, so those are the two ways in which the Bible does talk about love. Nowhere, to my knowledge, maybe a couple of passing references, but certainly in no major teaching in the Bible does the Bible address the issue of the kind of affinity that friendship consists of, the kind of connectedness that that brothers might have with one another, that sisters might have with one another, that friends have with one another, that kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Where you have an alter ego, where you just understand them because they are so much like you, and you understand their personal values, not just their spiritual values and existential commitments, but you understand their tastes and their quirks and their distinctively idiosyncratic personal values as well. The kind of stuff that friendship can be made of. We are not called upon to be other people's friends. And I think the primary reason for that is because it's not the sort of thing that you can command of another person. Friendship is not something you do. I think friendship is something that happens to you. Two people just come together and they click. You know, they just know each other. And they're comfortable with each other, and they can relax with each other, and they can reveal themselves to one another, and they can be themselves with respect to one another just because of the chemistry of that particular relationship. Well, God does not come along to me and say, that person needs a friend, be their friend. I just don't think that's ever commanded of us. And nor could it be. I can love them. I can respect them. I can proactively work toward their well-being. I mean, there's a lot I can do in relationship to them that I must do, I'm under obligation to do, godliness requires it of me, but it's not going to translate into being a bosom buddy, necessarily. I mean, it may, but it certainly won't necessarily do that. And yet, we all long for that. We would love for that to be the case. And oftentimes we'll come into a Christian community and will basically hold that over the community. Jesus says you have to be my friend. Jesus commanded you to love me. And in my mind, what that means is Jesus commanded you to be my friend. And in fact, that's really not what Jesus has ever commanded. I think it's entirely possible that we may go through our entire life lonely. I don't think there are any promises in the gospel at all that we will that come to Jesus and you will not be lonely. I mean, that's up to God to determine that. Some people go through life blind. Some people go through life deaf. Some people go through life single. Some people go through life poor, impoverished, without any material possessions. There are all kinds of ways that we are deprived and that we suffer and experience grief and sorrow. All kinds of ways. And God dictates whether I will and what form that suffering or sorrow is going to take in my life. And one of them may very well be that you're just not going to have a best friend. Not here, not now. But that's not why I'm a believer. That's not why I'd follow Jesus. That's not why this is interesting to me. At least it shouldn't be. This is interesting to me for other reasons, because I want to be, from the inside out, a person who's whole, who has integrity, who's rightly related to the creator of my being and the source of my life. That's why I'm a believer. And whatever else follows from that is God's business, but I'm committed to that in any case, regardless of whether I get the kind of connection with other people that I want. Okay, so all that's to say, it's an error in the thinking that leads us to come to the conclusion that if we're not engaged in intentional community, we are not loving one another as Jesus commanded us to love one another. There are those three errors. I don't remember what they were. Did I lose a page? There we go. Love does not entail, does not involve a connection, or does not involve connection in any sense that leads to intentional community, and the ambiguity of the word love itself. Okay, now having said that, that's all to say being a Christian disciple does not involve me entering into intentional community, but does the Bible say anything about living together as fellow believers? And the answer to that is yes. It says a lot, and I think it would be too tedious to go through everything the Bible has to say about that. I want to make just one point and then kind of illustrate that point tonight, and then I'll open it up for your questions and discussion. When all is said and done, I think what the Bible says about our living together is that the way to live with one another is to live in the light of what is true. If I simply live in the light of what is true, and what I mean by that is what the Bible teaches me is true, if I simply live my life in isolation, in all of my loneliness, seeking to make my choices, my attitudes, my actions conform to what is true, then I will be living with others in the right way. Oftentimes I think we think that, well, there's living the truth, there's living in the light of the gospel and all that, but then there's this other thing we need to do too, and that is we need to love one another in community. And that's a whole other set of skills or whole other set of truths or something like that. I don't think that's right. That I think everywhere we look in the New Testament, when the apostles are exhorting us to get along with one another, they're not exhorting us to get along with one another so that community can get built. They're exhorting us to get along with one another because that's the right way for me to be, whether or not community gets built or not. It's simply the truth that I should behave this way in any case, regardless of the consequences. Let me give you some examples, and hopefully this will become clear what I'm saying. I'm just going to go through a list of things that I think the New Testament says about living with one another. These are in no particular order, just random order. One thing that comes up quite frequently is that we should practice what they call forbearance. We should forbear the weaknesses of others. Well, what do they mean by that? Well, first of all, what they mean by that is, well, no. Why do they say that? The reason they say that is because if I don't forbear, I don't understand. I don't get it. I don't really believe the truth. I don't really understand the truth. Because the truth about all of you out there is you are incurable sinners. And as incurable sinners, you're going to do hurtful things. You're going to do selfish things. You're going to do proud things. You're going to make an ass out of yourself every now and then. The question is, how am I going to respond to it when you do that? Am I going to be annoyed that you are a sinner? And I think the apostle's perspective on that is, well, duh. I mean, why would that surprise you? What were you expecting? Of course they're sinful. Of course they're going to be selfish. Of course they're going to be proud and arrogant. Of course they're going to be grasping and demanding. That's what it means to be a sinner. It just oozes out of their pores to be that kind of person and to do those kinds of things. We're not going to get very far with relating to other people, children, the apostles are saying, if you don't understand what you're dealing with. Expect it. And instead of being annoyed by it, forbear. Give them room to be sinners. Give them some space. Just relax. Don't have a cow every time somebody sins against you. They just sinned against you. And be the way James, I like the way James puts it, if I rightly understand it. He says, love covers a multitude of sins. I think what he's getting at is, notice the dynamic that happens in life when I, in my sinfulness, victimize you, and you get ticked that I victimized you, and so you can hardly wait to somehow get back at me, and you get back at me better than I got you, which in turn makes me kind of angry, and I can hardly wait to get back at you, and we become a sin amplifier. That is, that in our insistence that we get back and take revenge, we're just amplifying evil back and forth between the two of us. What's going to stop it? James says love. Love covers a multitude. It just sort of puts the lid on and stops and stifles and smothers that sin that otherwise would just simply get amplified back and forth between us. So somebody somewhere along the line just needs to decide and make a commitment. It's really okay if you sin against me. I'm just going to take it. I'm just going to absorb it. I'm not going to do nothing with it. It's just going to stop here with me being victimized. That's okay. And that's the forbearance that the apostles counsel. My main point with respect to the main issue is, notice though, it's not primarily about, boys and girls, here's how your life can go better with one another. It's not a means to some other end. It's an end in itself. It's being a wise person to act that way. It's being someone who understands the reality that we live in to live that way. It's someone who's committed to the things of God to live that way. And whether or not it actually is effective in greasing the skids of human relationships is neither here nor there in the end. I still need to forbear because it's the right thing to do. It's the true thing to do. Another exhortation that comes up a number of times is to give preference to one another. In Romans 12, he says, give preference to one another in showing honor. In Philippians, and let's look at this passage a little bit more detail. I love this passage. I hate this passage, but I love this passage. I hate how convicting it is, but Philippians 2, therefore, if there is any encouragement in Christ, if there is any consolation of love, if there is any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. Here's where I'm most interested in. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interest, but also for the interests of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and being made in the likeness of men. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. For this reason also God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee will bow of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Now there's actually several points he's making here. Let me just highlight two or three of them. The first one is, notice this basic exhortation: do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourselves. That idea of making the other person more important than me is very radical, very profound, and yet very, very true. And he goes on to describe Jesus' behavior and says, model Jesus' behavior. Jesus was far more concerned about your and my well-being than his own well-being. It was more important that you be served than that he be served. That's the model for us. Now, again, why? Because it makes society go better, it makes a better commune. It does do all that on the one hand, but what's more important to Paul is because it's true. Because that's what it means to be a child of God. Because that's what it means to be like our brother Jesus. Making a commitment to those kinds of values is authentic spirituality. That's why you do it. Then he goes on, and for years I didn't understand this. Actually, it was Brian and I were in a Bible study that Logan is a part of as well, if you know Logan. And Logan suggested this other way of looking at this passage, and he's got to be right. This just makes too much sense. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, and so on. I had always read that as, look at the act of humility that Jesus engaged in when he incarnated himself in human form. He was God, but he did not stay God. Instead, he humbled himself by condescending to become a human being. And I had always read it that way. But actually, that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is something I think far more profound. As Jesus was walking down the dusty roads of Galilee, he was God incarnate. That was God himself, the very creator of all of reality, embodied in human form, walking down the roads of Galilee. Now, if you're God incarnate walking down the road of Galilee, you can expect to have a little attitude. You know, you want some respect. And Paul's point is, that's exactly what Jesus didn't do. He didn't cop an attitude. Nothing about his life involved him copying an attitude. He didn't require that you give him the respect that was his due, that you give him the honor and deference that was his due. He never demanded it. And it just, I mean, I just shudder when I think about that, because here we are, these puny little specks of stardust, and we get offended if we don't get the respect that's our due. And here he is, the very creator God himself in human form, and it doesn't really make any difference to him whether you give him the respect that he's due. It may sorrow him that you don't get it, but for his part, I don't need it. I don't want it. Don't kowtow to me. That's fine. He did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. That is, his identity with God, his equality with God, was not something that he couldn't let go of with respect to how other people viewed him and treated him and thought of him. And that's why he's the model. That's why Paul points him out as the model. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus. The same attitude that you saw him manifest, make that your attitude as well. Well, what does that translate into in our relationship with other people? We must not be grasping. We must not demand what is our due in relationship to other people. To do so is to not get it. It's to not understand what this is about. And then the other thing we see there is the obedience and the sacrifice of Jesus, the obedience to God. But that entailed sacrifice on his part for other people. And Jesus is often set out for us as an example of the nature of love and how love needs to act. If I am going to love you, that's going to entail my sacrificing for you. Anything short of that is not love with the kind of love that Jesus loved us. James tells us, Paul tells us in Romans, don't show favoritism. Don't be sucking up to the rich people and mistreating the poor people and ignoring the poor people. People are people. Doesn't really make any difference whether they have high social standing or low social standing. It doesn't make any difference whether they are highly intelligent or as dumb as a stick. It doesn't really make any difference. I mean, nothing about the variations and the differences in human beings should in any way have any effect on the respect that I show them. They are a human being made in the image of God. That's all I need to know in terms of how I relate to them. Don't show favorites. Now again, why? Because it's going to make community go better? It will, that's true, for the most part. On the other hand, you can have a community of snobs quite easily. The reason we don't show favoritism is not about the result of community. It's about the end of being the kind of person with the kind of authentic spirituality that understands the true nature of human beings, that truly gets it, that is truly wise, that truly has a possession of the wisdom that knows a human being made in the image of God is a human being made in the image of God. Their value to me is not measured by what utility they have for me, what good they can do me, what they have to offer me. Their value is defined by God and their relationship to God. Plenty of exhortations to just flat out love one another, but in what sense is that? I've already talked about that, in the sense of willing and promoting their well-being, their good. And then finally, it's not the end, it's the end of my list, it's not the end of what the New Testament says, don't strive with one another, but live at peace with one another. I think there are a lot of things that go into this, but all of the things that go into this, once again, come back to because you need to be rightly related to what's true and rightly committed to what's true. Some strife comes from perverse lusts within us. I think that's what Paul was getting at when he writes to Timothy, flee youthful lusts. There is this tendency, especially when we're younger, to compete and win and conquer. And if we can't do it with bow and arrow and spears, then we do it with arguments. I'm going to show you how much superior I am in wit to you, and I am going to bring you to your knees intellectually. We may not say it in so many words, but incredible perverse desire in us young people to do that. So part of wisdom is having the grace to have some ass look like he beat you in intellectual competition. It's okay. And in doing that, we don't fight, we don't compete, we don't wrestle, we don't strive with words. We just simply listen, hear, and wait for the opportunity to interject some wisdom into the relationship. Part of not striving is being merciful people. And why are we merciful people? We're merciful people because our Father in heaven is merciful. He was merciful to us. I can do no less than to be merciful to others. Remember that famous parable about the king who forgives a bajillion units of currency, whatever it is, to somebody who then goes out and beats up some debtor that owes them a nickel, you know? And how absolutely not only irrational that is, but you know, perverse that is. I have been given this gift of this incredible mercy, and yet I'm going to demand justice from you. And that contrast, the irony of that, is constantly explored in the New Testament. No, the truth is that we must emulate the very mercy with which God has dealt with us. And when you're merciful to people, you don't strive with them. You just let it go. You don't need to get back at them. Okay. That's the end of my list. That's good enough for now. Just to reiterate my main point, but when all is said and done, all the emphasis in the New Testament is not on engaging in community for the sake of engaging in community, but for being rightly and truly related to God for the sake of true spirituality itself. It's about me in the end. It's about the question of who am I? Not what are we doing together, but who am I as an individual? That's the number one question. Take your questions or comments or... Wes, I have no idea what time it is, if you could...
I wanted to say, I really agree with what you're saying. It really makes sense to me. And can I make sense of this? I don't know. But it makes me think of how, having been someone who was really involved most of my life with mainstream Christianity, as I think of it, and seeing coming into this community was kind of like stepping out of mainstream to a degree. I think there's something there that people are wary of, and I think rightly so, who've grown up in traditional church or been part of that, with that this idea you're talking about of for the community, loving one another and all those things. It's because a lot of times when people step out of that, they're going after or they're following someone's idea about what, a different idea about what God is, and often it's viewed from the biblical thing, and that's how...
I'm sorry, at what from the biblical thing? What?
Skewed from the biblical... Oh. Thing. And that's how like cult groups have started sometimes, and people almost looking, you know, it seems like it comes from something inside of someone sometimes wanting to do something different or wanting frustrated maybe with what they learned, knowing there's something different. And I'm not, I mean, it's different for everyone who does this, but I think sometimes a group is formed that's just, okay, something's wrong, you know, there were things wrong with traditional churches, so we'll start our own group here. And there's often a charismatic leader or some idea that people gather around, and that becomes, in itself, it's fairly easy to see that there are things wrong there. And as it becomes a bigger group, a lot of times then they get into the same issues of, well, let's keep our community going and all these things. And so that, it's just, there's a difference. What you're saying is the way it should be, and I think it's good to know that it can happen or come closer to happening when people, like you're saying, come together or end up coming together because they just, hey, I'm seeing this way, you are too, here we are.
Right.
And that it can be, make people resistant who look at that and say, well, that's just becoming a cult or something, but don't understand that this is what's happening.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, two things come to mind. I don't think I can remember them, but shoot. Actually, I don't have anything to say to that. it'll come to me. Well, one of them is mentioning cults. I think that comes from the focus on community as an essential aspect of Christian discipleship, is that in order to be an authentic believer, you need to be a member of a community, namely ours. And so what happens is you get this sociological dynamic where you are held captive, sociological captive to the group. A lot of pressure is put on you. If you leave us, you're leaving God. If you leave us, you're forsaking the truth. Now, all of us will, to one degree or another, be tempted to feel that way. But any of us who know anything about this thing have to admit, no, there's a lot of reasons to leave us. And somebody may not be forsaking the truth at all in leaving us. They're just frankly have seen some things there that are kind of obnoxious, and they don't want to hang around. Now, if I'm honest, I have to acknowledge that that's got to be the case in any community that I'm a part of or that we're a part of. I mean, all of the cultures we build are going to be have glaring weaknesses of one kind or another. But like you say, there is something to be said for a community that holds its people lightly. That is, they're free to come and go. If you want to fellowship with us because you find that you're on the same wavelength with us, fine. If not, God bless you. And to be able to say that is in a lot of ways certainly a more comfortable community in the end for a lot of people, but that's not the main issue. It's a truer community. I mean, it's much more in touch with the reality of who we are as human beings. But there really is no reason why, if community comes up organically from people who share a view of the world in common, then there's no need to enforce it. There's no need to enforce loyalty on your members. And hopefully I'll think of my other, but I lost it. So.
Okay, I have like a bunch of questions, but I'll only ask one or two because Anne and Kelly will glare at me if I don't.
Living together.
Yeah, isn't it great? Okay, one of my big questions is you said that God doesn't command us to be friends with everyone. And in that context, wouldn't it be extreme selfishness to not be a friend to someone who asks you to?
Well, it depends what you mean by be a friend. If what you mean by be a friend is, you know, treat me with kindness and like a creature of God, then yes, it would be selfish. But when I use the word friend, I'm deliberately meaning that kind of relationship where there's this deeper simpatico that comes from having a soul in common, that kind of thing. And I can't make that happen. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I am who I am, as weird as that is, I am who I am, and we just may not connect at that level. So for some, I mean, I've had that happen to me in life, and a couple times people came up to me and said, I want you to be my friend. And my response was, okay. what are you supposed to do with that? I like you. I'll if you call me, I'll talk to you. But I even express that is that I won't turn you away. I mean, I'll be as kind to you as I can. No, I want something more. I want something deeper. Well, I'm sorry, but that just cannot be commanded of another person. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. So then I'll move on to a different question. My other question then would be, a lot of times I hear, I've heard a couple times in different sermons that Abba means Father and that God has this really deep affection for us. Hmm. And that's the kind of affection we should have for other Christians. So what then, my question is, primarily, are we supposed to be friends with God? Because I have heard that before, where if you become a Christian, you might still be lonely, but you have God to lean on when you really need a friend. You know, you call out to God and He'll comfort you or something. So, can you answer the unspoken question that I meant to ask?
Yes, most certainly. First of all, I don't think that's what Abba means. I, I, I know I've heard that they translate it daddy, something like that, and that there's all the affection that's involved in something like that. But if you look at the context, particularly the one in Romans, what he's going on to say is that if God is your father, then you are heirs. And it's a legal reality, a legal metaphor that he's talking about, not an emotional, nurturing metaphor. So I don't think there he's saying that we have this deep, profound emotional connection of a God who's affectionate, who feels affection toward us. I don't think that's his point. His point is there's this incredible inheritance that is ours because we are his children. Furthermore, I just frankly don't think it's true. I mean, I know that we teach this. It has been commonplace in Christian culture to teach that either God or even more often Jesus becomes the replacement for the human warmth and human connection that I lack. But that's okay. I don't need any human connection any longer. I've got Jesus. Well, I mean, I don't mean this blasphemously. I have the utmost respect for Jesus. But Jesus, who's gone off to a faraway country to receive a kingdom, is a poor replacement for a friend who can embrace me physically, and their physical presence and warmth can supply that emotional need. Jesus doesn't make up for that, doesn't replace that, at least not now. Maybe in the kingdom of God, when we see him face to face and he's among us, but not now. So, and God does not do that, except God is amazing, who will, at some times of incredible emotional need, just reach out and touch us in just the right way, and we feel a connection as a momentary, tangible, yeah, God is capable of doing that. I think he's done that in my life at times, but he would not let me make that the staple of my existence.
What about the James Taylor song?
Right.
So then is there any validity to the fact that because God came down on earth in human form, is there any validity to the idea that you can take comfort in the fact that he can understand what I'm going through?
Yes, absolutely.
But it's still not the huggy thing.
But what?
It's still not the huggy thing.
Right. Yeah. If you want a hug, don't come to Jesus. Because that's not what it's about. Our discipleship to Jesus is not about having my emotional needs met. It's about having my more profound and deeper personal, existential, spiritual needs met. And that may or may not translate into emotional needs being met. By spells, it will. I mean, my emotional response to that is going to be all over the map. Just depends on what day and what hour you catch me. I mean, there are times in my... I'll never forget, I was in college, and one of the most memorable moments in my life, do you know who Moshe Rosen is? I don't know if he's still around. He was the founder of Jews for Jesus. And I went to a lecture by him, and the first words out of his mouth, I can't do this justice, I'm sorry, I'm not an actor, but he's a Jew with a Brooklyn accent, right? I mean, just a Jewish Brooklyn accent. Sometimes... people tell you, come to Jesus and he will make you happy. I'm here to tell you I came to Jesus and sometimes he makes me very unhappy. But it's always real, was his next word. And I think he just nailed it. Absolutely. That's absolutely right. It's not happiness we want, it's reality we want. It's truth we want. We want to be real and we want to be connected to what is real. And that's the foundation of, that's what makes us stay here. That's what makes us believers. That's why we keep going this way, because we want reality and truth. And what's the payoff for me? Well, sometimes it seems like there's not much payoff at all right now, here and now in this lifetime. Sometimes there's a lot of grief and sorrow and suffering being a disciple of Jesus. But in the midst of the sorrow and the suffering and the pain, I know I'm rightly connected to what's true and lasting and everlasting and eternal, and that's what counts.
So if I understand what you're saying, community is not the point. Our right relationship to God is the point. And so my question is, as these communities, I mean, we're going to connect with each other because of our relationship to Christ and that connection.
That was my other point. Go ahead. I got it.
Yes.
You just remind me of
okay.
that.
Okay. I thought you were pointing. Yes, to Christ. No. Indeed.
Great. God speaking. Would you shut up?
Right. My question is, especially with your answer to your question back there, with our tendency to, at least I know I have a tendency to pick out the things that I like, and with our tendency to be very temporal with hopping around to different communities, finding what we like and that kind of thing. Could you kind of comment on the value of being committed to a community of people that has grown out organically from our commitment to Christ? The value of being committed to that because it's a community of people seeking the truth. I mean, in light of our tendency to just kind of float around and do our own thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you rightly point out, what I'm not saying is that there's anything wrong with forming communities. There's nothing wrong, and that was my second point to you. It's not that there's anything wrong with forming communities, it's just that that's not the point. And in fact, it's sort of inevitable that we will form various communities. We are people. We are social animals. So that's going to be natural that we do that. Did you use the word loyal?
No.
Okay. What was the word you used? Being committed to the people that we're committed to is a good thing, I think. The problem is, oftentimes we have a tendency to put our claws in one another to make that exclusive. That's appropriate in marriage, but only in marriage. The only exclusive relationship in human existence ought to be the marriage relationship, where I have a relationship with my wife that I don't have with any other human being, and that's as it should be. But friendship is not exclusive. And the stuff that those communities that you're talking about is not exclusive. And so it becomes pathological if our commitment to the particular community that we're a part of forecloses on us being able to participate in other communities as well. I mean, why not? I mean, other than we're finite and don't have that much time, but within the bounds of our finiteness to go ahead and connect with and relate to other people. And a healthy community is one that lets you do that. That they don't see you as being disloyal if you don't do everything with them and only with them and so on and so forth. There's something pathological about that. But otherwise, yeah, it's a virtue to be a faithful partner to the unspoken commitments that we've made in a community. I think that's great.
This is a really abundant topic, and especially after having read McIntyre last quarter, I've thought a lot about it, and it's really interesting. So I'll limit my question to one, but I'm wondering, given the fact that we are individuals, and in the end we stand alone before the throne of God at judgment, community with other believers something that we should seek at all costs in this life, given the fact that it does create opportunities by which we come to know ourselves that we couldn't, like, if we were just to go live off as hermits by ourselves? I mean, what is the importance and value of, like, living in community,
okay,
being related to each other?
Well, if the contrast is between living as a hermit or living in social relationships, yes, social relationships, I think, are a wonderful classroom for me to gain wisdom. becoming a hermit can be, usually probably is, although I can't speak about every situation, but usually is a way of running away from myself and running away from the truth about myself, and that's not a good thing, that's a bad thing. But I don't know that that's necessarily, I mean, that's just social relationships. I mean, any pagan will serve you in the same way as a fellow believer in that regard. In fact, sometimes even more effectively. So I'm not sure that's the primary reason to be in community with believers. I think the primary reason to be in community with believers is we really do desperately need one another for what the Bible calls edification and mutual encouragement and so on, what we would, in our language, would probably call a reality check. We often desperately need that. I mean, I think the church, if you will, is a place where we can go and borrow somebody else's eyes for a while. That is, I'm confused, I'm kind of blinded by desire or by pain or something in my life has blinded me. I can't see what I must see right now. Look out there for me and tell me what you see. Tell me what's real. Tell me what's true, because I can't see it right now. I think that's the greatest service that believers do to one another, is just lend their eyes to the other person temporarily until they can see for themselves again. And that only fellow believers can do. And I mean, that's why community with fellow believers is crucial, I think.
So is an established community, such as like the Mackenzie Study Center or something, is that something that we should seek, like, in this life? Is it really crucial?
I don't know that it has to be established. I don't think that's really the relevant issue. Given the value that they serve, wisdom is far more important than bricks and mortar. I mean, just associate that. What's I think is crucial, it would be a mistake to not do, is to seek out people who have the wisdom of the scriptures that they can share with me and can speak to me out of that wisdom. But whether it's formal or informal, small or large, none of that matters, I don't think.
I was just curious what you might think of the place in Genesis when Abraham is called the friend of God, and the import that has. And then when Jesus in the New Testament talks about, you know, before you've been called servants, I'm not sure, but now I call you friends.
Now I call you friends.
Mm-hmm. What kind of import does that have? I mean, obviously, you know, Jesus was there for them, and he's not in the same way with us. So there's obviously a unique relation there.
I'm sorry, but
Jesus is present with them physically, you know, as a friend, potentially, I would imagine. So that might play into it. But just in the sense in which he makes, what kind of distinction is he making when he calls someone a friend as opposed to not a friend? You know, when he calls Abraham a friend, what import does that have?
I can't speak to the issue of Abraham because I haven't thought about it. And it'd be interesting, is there anything in the particular Hebrew word used that helps it? I don't know. I haven't looked at that. With respect to Jesus, he tells us the import in that passage. If you go on, he says, because, I mean, the role of a servant is just to do what the master says. But he says, but now I call you friends, and he goes on to say, because I'm going to share with you what I know, I'm no longer going to keep it from you. And so I don't think it speaks to the issue that we were talking about earlier about Jesus being a friend. It's simply a metaphor, and there's one aspect of friendship that he says is relevant for understanding what your relationship with me is going to be like now, and that is my knowledge, my understanding, my wisdom I'm going to share it with you, and it's going to be yours now. And he's speaking there to the apostles. I think he really meant that in a unique sense. They're going to become the spokesman for Jesus. I mean, they're going to be the authority on what Jesus taught. Well, they can't if they don't understand what Jesus taught, but he's going to, as we know elsewhere from his parakletos, the spirit of truth, that understanding is going to be imparted to them, making them, he says, my friends, I think that's the sense in which he's using the word friends there. Maybe there's more. I'd have to look at it. I'm not real fresh on that passage, but going by memory, that's the most prominent part of that passage that stands out.
Jack, I know you've already spoken about this topic in lots of different ways, but could you connect what you've been saying to a word that's tossed around a lot in the church from the Bible, koinonia? Do you think koinonia is?
Okay. Yeah, koinonia just comes from the root in Greek is the word for common. So koinonia is the state of having something in common. And it can be used in a lot of different ways in a lot of different contexts. For example, that's the word that's used. Let me think. Am I remembering this right? I better not say it because I'm trusting my memory. But in most contexts in the New Testament, what it is that we share in common is a knowledge of God, the gospel, the identity of Jesus, the truth about Jesus. It's sharing that in common that is the bond that unites us. And one of the words that's used to describe that is koinonia.
I think I have a question or a point of clarification. You talked about friendship not being exclusive.
Not being what?
Exclusive, uh-huh. I think. And it seems like maybe there's a couple spheres of friendship that we're referring to. I don't know, right? I had a friend visit last. She's one of my dearest friends, like soulmate kind of friends that I think of when you're talking about not the kind of person, it's not obligatory, it's mutual, whatever. Okay, she's a gift. And we're chatting or whatever, and we thought about inviting someone else over while we were chatting, and I was really happy that she was open to that. And because there is a sense that we're not exclusive, we would welcome another into our dialogue. If someone else showed up, our dialogue might look a little different because I do have a certain kind of exclusive relationship with her that I wouldn't necessarily share those parts of myself that I share with her in the way that I do with her. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And there seems to be something appropriate to me about that in the
sure.
sense that friendship is a gift. And like you were saying, if someone comes to you and says, I want to be your friend and you don't have the it feels more like maybe a social or moral obligation in a way to extend love to them because that's what you ought to do. That's very different than having a gift that's a friendship. And so I just wanted to put that out there as maybe a distinction or something. I wanted to clarify.
So were you wondering if when I said friendship is not exclusive that I'm denying that a relationship could be unique? Is that?
I'm not saying
yeah,
denial, Jeff.
No, I'm not saying that. I mean, what I'm saying is if another man shares my wife is being unfaithful to me. If another person shares my friend, there's no unfaithfulness going on at all. That's
part of what I'm responding out of is being in a culture where it was kind of my job to be friends with people and having someone say, you know, then 10 years ago, well, friendship is by nature exclusive. Well, actually reading it in Fort Lipton and that being really refreshing for me, thinking that, oh, I don't have to share that kind of intimacy just because somebody asks for it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the distinction.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we pray for our souls, Lord. Thank you for the word and bless the word as it's taught and unpacked this morning for us. In Jesus' name, amen.